I'm Jordy Morgan. This is Fall Back Up. Welcome, and thanks for taking some time to listen. This podcast is designed to provide you with engaging and thoughtful insights into Atlantic Canada through conversations with business leaders, innovators, and high performers. Today, a conversation with lawyer, politician, thought leader, and facilitator, Danny Graham. Danny Graham is best known as the former leader of the Nova Scotia Liberal Party and MLA for Halifax Citadel. He's now serving as the Chief Engagement Officer of Engage Nova Scotia. Over the past three decades, Danny has held senior positions in business, law, government, and politics. He's currently counsel to McGinnis Cooper, advising on business matters, collective social responsibility, and Aboriginal law. He's been a lead counsel at all levels of court, including the Supreme Court of Canada. He's acted as an advisor to Justice Canada and the United Nations, and consultant to the governments of Thailand, Jamaica, Tanzania, and Ukraine. In Nova Scotia, he's been the province's chief negotiator on Aboriginal rights in the Made in Nova Scotia process. Danny helped author We Choose Now, a playbook for Nova Scotians. It's a 10-year plan examining the economic future of the province. He was the chair of the Nova Scotia Restorative Justice Program, the Smart Justice Network of Canada, and Envision Halifax. He also sat on the board of the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives and St. Francis Xavier University. Danny leads an active life outside of work as a husband and father, and as the co-founder of a wilderness retreat focused on personal development. I spoke to Danny at my office in downtown Halifax, and our conversation covered how he became involved in politics, his passion for restorative justice, his decision to leave and care for his wife during her cancer treatment, and his views on the current state of political discourse.
My name is Danny Graham. I'm the Chief Engagement Officer for Engage Nova Scotia. Most of the time, I work as counsel to the law firm of McGinnis Cooper for a little bit of that time as well.
And where were you born?
I was born in Antigonish, Nova Scotia in 1961. I grew up there for a short time, and my family moved around until we settled in Sydney around grade one, and all my formative years were in Sydney before I went off to St. Evex.
I'm beginning to think that Antigonish is sort of the epicenter of all things political in Nova Scotia. Is it?
Catholic and political. I'm not sure, but an awful lot happened there. Antigonish is still very much a place that I call home. We have a family cottage there that my nine siblings and I continue to share that was bought by my parents back in the early 50s. And it has tremendous meaning for us. There is something, I think, that where Antigonish has been affected by the farmers and the fishers and by the priests and nuns, including, you know, icons like Moses Cody and Jimmy Tompkins, who really sort of created, I think, a sense of community based on values that were aligned in some sense of the collective and not just the individual.
It's interesting, I think, when people would think, what's sort of the intellectual center of Nova Scotia? A lot of folks would think about Halifax, but there is that case to be made that Antigonish actually harbors a whole lot more of that.
Lots of centers with interesting places. I think Antigonish and St. Evex through the Cody Institute and the Extension Department would see itself as one of the hubs around social justice in particular, you know, leveling the playing field for the little guy. And as in the words of Reverend Cody, you know, for people to become the masters of their own destiny, realizing the power of what he called the little guy. So to be a force in their community and in the world.
What was the most important part of your time at St. Evex?
Meeting my wife, Sheila Nolan, in my third year. I went to St. Evex on a hockey scholarship, and I had defined myself as a hockey player for my entire life. I dabbled in some things, but by and large, it was Cape Breton hockey player, up and down my wing. That was how I defined my life. But in my second year, after I had an injury in a game against UPEI resulting in surgery, I came back in my second year and I really wasn't quite ready, and I got cut from the team. And it turned out to be probably one of the most important events in my life in a positive way. It was also one of the most painful things that I've ever experienced in my life. So I did, as a result of that turned my attention from hockey and toward student activities. I became involved in the students' union and got to know people who I otherwise wouldn't have. So it was all good. But it was the sudden change of direction that happened at the start of my second year that really made it an enormous difference. My family's history with Saint-Evex goes back to my grandfather and all the way down to my two of my children, including my dad and my in-laws and so on. So the place has had a huge impact on me, and I feel fortunate to have that association.
You say you went to play hockey, but you must have had an academic pursuit in mind. Did you plan on going into law?
Not at first. I was in the science program. We had this wonderful dentist back in Sydney who seemed to have the perfect life. He played hockey on Wednesdays. He had a backyard pool. And I thought, well, that's the life I'd like. And in order to get there, I needed to study biology. But it was later, I'd actually split my academic time between a biology degree. It was a science major, double major in science and business administration. And it was the first time they had offered it. And I think I might have been the first person to graduate from that program. So it was a combined a four-year program. And then I went to work with the Sobey Company. They were looking for a business student. And so I guess I emphasized that. I went to their head office and worked with them for 2 years before I realized that I'd like to go back to school again. So I applied to law school. And it was really only after I left my undergrad that the idea of going into law became more of a reality for me. I enjoyed my time with what was then Atlantic Shopping Centers. It's now Crombie REIT. And it was really exciting work. I moved to Halifax. I think I was about 22 when I was managing Simpson's Mall over on Mumford Road, when it was a mall and not a place where there's principally offices now, where Winners is and all the rest. That was almost 35 years ago.
What flipped the switch to law?
I guess I felt that it was important to have choices and freedom. And I was increasingly interested in the way that systems worked, and a law degree helped me make sense of the world to a greater degree. I realized as well that I was in a family business and in the Sobey business, and that I had a great relationship with the family, but I realized that there's an aspect of being free that involves making sure that there's not a ceiling in the room when you really want to do a wider variety of things. So when I arrived to write my LSATs, I looked behind me and my older brother was in the desk behind me as well. And it was around that time we just discovered that we were both interested in going back to law school, and we both ended up going through law school in the same year, actually, at Dalhousie.
Did you enjoy the experience?
I loved law school.
What is it about law school that you loved?
There were a couple of things. In my undergrad, it was the social life that really was. And in law school, it was more the classroom. It was the topics that were being opened up to me just felt fascinating. And I used to think, one of the reasons that I guess people used to speak about thinking like a lawyer, which I frankly thought was a snobbish way of describing things, with the logic and sort of breaking down all the different principles of thinking through an argument. But what law school did for me was actually untangle my reasoning, and it separated out some of the emotional from the logical. It helped me see the world through a more disciplined lens than I had before. And, you know, I took human rights and women in the law, along with the core courses as well, that really had an important influence on my view of the world. So you're at law school, you're able to take tax, and you're able to take human rights and everything in between. And I wish I could have stayed a couple more years.
One example I read in an article that you wrote for a law publication was a discussion that at that time Professor Wade McLaughlin had around restorative justice, and how it took your worldview from your perspective on crime and punishment. And it really looked like a pretty cataclysmic shift in how you were thinking about this stuff.
Yeah, well, it was. I eventually had a cataclysmic shift. But, I mean, you have to remember that I grew up in a rough-and-tumble Cape Breton home where I was one of five boys, and I had five sisters. And, you know, there was a aspects of, we had a great childhood, but you know, amongst 10 of us, there's some rough justice. And if you messed up, you got a whack. And if you really messed up, you got a double whack. And that's how I thought that the world sort of operated. So when I went to law school and took the introduction to criminal law, and our professor, now the premier of Prince Edward Island, Wade McLaughlin, was telling us about this thing called restorative justice, I thought that it was a flaky, soft touch, weak kneed kind of thing that you'd normally expect to hear from a law professor. And I probably kept some of those thoughts through my time at law school. I took, you know, criminal procedure, and I worked in the criminal clinic, and I started to gradually open my eyes more. But it was only when I became, after being a corporate lawyer for a period of time, I did what was at that time the unthinkable. I left one of the big firms doing corporate commercial work to work at Nova Scotia Legal Aid. And that was, for me, the most important professional decision I've probably ever made on a couple of fronts. The first was that it made me realize that there is a risk-reward equation around going to the things that inspire you and are more aligned with what it is that you're, you feel called to do in whatever fashion, big or small, that is. And so going to Legal Aid introduced me to a population of people, many of whom just didn't have a chance from the very beginning of their lives. And I was fortunate to hear the most intimate aspects of how they came to be in conflict with the law. And as I broke down all of these things that they had done and all the ways that they've messed up and harmed other people, and as I processed them through the conveyor belt of our criminal justice system, which hasn't changed a great deal, except in Nova Scotia and a few other places in over that period of time, I realized that what the professor was talking about in my first year at law school actually made a great deal of sense. And I spent a lot of my life committed to the topic of restorative justice. I still work as a volunteer, both here and internationally.
I've had some personal experience with restorative justice through my family, and it worked. I mean, I think it's a very effective tool that can be used as a, you know, out of a quiver of tools that might be available to you in any given criminal justice system. But do you think that we use it enough? Is it integrated well enough in Nova Scotia?
Well, the first thing I'd say is that Nova Scotia is recognized internationally as one of the go-to jurisdictions for restorative approaches to conflict in the world.
Really?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Does that come out of our experience with the Indigenous community? Or is it simply that we've been able to integrate it into our existing criminal justice system?
Well, it's not just in criminal justice. You'll note that in Nova Scotia now, the Home for Colored Children inquiry is now through a restorative approach. It's at the Human Rights Commission. It's in our schools. And, of course, it's started in the youth justice system in Nova Scotia back in the mid-90s. Mm. The biggest reason for the difference, there are a couple. One was that when we started it, we made a conscious decision to be connected to government enough that we would get the support through the system and the buy-in that was required by the police, by corrections, victim services, prosecution, the judiciary, etc. But also independent enough that it would still come back to the question of what it means to be members of society. So we had a really, I think, solid concept to start us, and enough support in those early stages to sort of create the foundation that was required. In other parts of the world, North America, Canada included, it has remained more of a grass fire in small pockets and not as integrated as it is in Nova Scotia. That we also had some fantastic champions, one of whom continues to this day, Jennifer Llewellyn, who's a professor at the law school, who's a pioneer and recognized as one of a handful of theorists in the world who really understand the significant nature of a restorative approach, and also brings us back to the understanding that for most of time, not just with our Indigenous communities, but for most of time, through almost all civilizations, a restorative approach was the norm. It was only a few hundred years ago where the monarchs started to say, we want a cut of the action, and you guys are sort of making amends between each other. If you're going to pay a fine, you're going to pay it to me. And if you're going to be penalized, I'll supervise you in these things called prisons and jails, which were hardly a known thing. There were the gallows a long, long time ago, but we never used jails in those times in the way that many countries have been using them in more recent generations.
I want to turn a bit of a corner here and talk about how you found yourself making your way into the political world. Was that just people kept asking you, or how did it happen?
Well, I made a promise to Sheila when we got married. The only thing she asked me to do was never to get involved in politics. I said, well, of course, I've never been involved in politics. And so everything bumped along without any expectation. I was a lawyer, and I was doing fun stuff, having led the start of the Nova Scotia Restorative Justice Program. I was invited by Justice Canada to come up and to be a policy expert in advancing the initiative that was replacing the Young Offenders Act with the Youth Criminal Justice Act. And it was my ideal job because I was going to be the point person for restorative justice. And I was there for a couple of years, and it was time to kind of decide whether to stay or whether to return to Nova Scotia. I was 2 weeks from being before as a justice policy person, from advancing the first of its kind national program on restorative justice. And it was September of 2001, and 9/11 hit. And I was asked to stop. This was going to be a huge restorative justice program. I thought was going to change the landscape of the way that we were dealing with criminal justice writ large across the country. And then you had this cataclysmic shakeup. And the associate deputy minister at the time, Rick Mosley, came to me and he said, look, we're having to write an anti-terrorism piece of legislation. And we know of your court experience and would like you to be on the team to write this piece of legislation, C-35. It was the fall of 2001 afterward. And so I breathed deeply because he said, we're only going to pause restorative justice right now. And he said, I'd like you to join the team. Anyway, I joined the team and had the unusual experience of being an advisor to members of parliament who needed technical understanding of this really important piece of legislation. And what I realized in the course of this was that I was just couriering speeches that our team had written in the department, and the members of parliament, frankly, didn't understand or know about. And I had been encouraged. I had never attended a political meeting in my adult life, but had been for any political party, but had been encouraged to come back, and then in particular to run for the leadership of the Nova Scotia Liberal Party. And I kept saying no. But the experience of going between the Justice Department and to the House of Commons on that piece of legislation and saying, oh my heavens, the state of our public and political discourse is just so low. If they're reading, like somebody from junior high, a speech that my colleagues wrote and aren't their words, then something needs to shake things up. And so that was a bit of it was a real wake-up call for me. And so I went home and said to Sheila in Ottawa, I think we've got to rethink this idea of going back to Nova Scotia. And she knew from the look in my eye that I meant it, that I wanted to become involved in public life. And I'd been reading countless reports about the way our children in the Maritimes and Nova Scotia had been trailing on indicators of health and education and so on. And I thought, you know, I can't just stand on the sidelines if I've got an opportunity to make a difference. And so that was in November. Our family was moved in December.
And what was the aha moment you had coming into retail politics? Because what you're talking about is changing the province. The reality of politics itself can very often be quite a different thing.
Well, there are countless aha moments. One is that I realized so many people who get involved in politics get involved for the most altruistic and noble reasons. The context eventually causes too many of them, and I say this for all parties, to kind of lose their way. And it's like a conspiracy of conflict that sort of comes together. Everybody's looking. It's like you're put into a cockfight, like two roosters, and everybody's circling around saying they're going to go at it eventually. They're going to go at it. And eventually you do. you know, people drop their gloves. That was the aha. And to a certain extent, it is, you're goaded by all aspects of your own team, by the culture, and by the media.
I understand that this is, it is difficult, and it's very often, it creates cynicism among people, that the adversarial nature of it. But at the same time, do you think that there's value in the adversarial political system insofar as that it acts as a crucible, creating better policy? I think that that's probably why it was set up to be as such. Very often, I think people get distracted simply for on the retail political side. But do you think that there's any value in that?
Yeah, if you were to describe what a parliamentary democracy was on paper and were to imagine the checks and balances, when you take out the reality of how it works, there's a lot of virtue in that, the notion of that system. And I don't necessarily describe it as adversarial. The party system has benefits and weaknesses to it. But when you think about the number of reforms that we have introduced to our parliamentary system since we adopted it 150 years ago, can you think, apart from giving Indigenous people and women the vote, how many real innovations have happened? So it's part of why, to a certain extent, I'm rather committed to the idea of public engagement. I think that the magic of democracy is ultimately about collective wisdom. By this ridiculously fluky, I think, mathematical equation, when people go to the polls and give you their gut about who should be leading in public, we've done better. You know, with the ebb and flow of that, we have done incredibly well. It arguably is the greatest invention over the last 100 years that's, you know, humans have sort of enjoyed. At the same time, it is, in its current form, in the way it's executed on, it's like a Model T Ford. If anybody goes down to the legislature or the House of Commons, no matter who's in government, and listens to the discourse and the faux distrust, actually, that sometimes gets expressed, it doesn't reflect well on the choices that people are forced to make or the institution generally. There are so many more ways to bring a level of civility and thoughtfulness into our political discourse. And I think the responsibility is not just with the political actors. It's with everybody in that regard. And it includes, you know, the Fifth Estate, the media. And you've been a member, obviously, for an important part of your life in that. And I say this with the greatest respect, because that, too, is a very noble profession. But like the political people, you start to numb yourself to expectations that, I guess, it's always going to be this way.
You almost have to step out of it and leave it alone for a while to come back with a fresh set of eyes, because I think you do, in both the political framework and the media, to get some perspective on it.
A story that I've told before relates to a topic that I know you invite your listeners to touch on from time to time, and it's about their mistakes. And I was only, I've never done the math on how long I was the leader of the party. I think it was probably 2 years, close to 2 years. I was an MLA for a little more than that. But my time in politics was quite short. You know, my first time I attended a political meeting was one to determine whether I should run for the leadership of a party that I hadn't always voted for.
Really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So it was sort of a flash period in my life. And when I left, I think I probably enjoyed the benefit, even though it wasn't of my own choice, because Sheila had become sick and I ended up having to leave to sort of be, to attend more fully to our family needs. I think I probably left at a time when, had I stayed for all, you know, double that time, I'm sure that my perspective would have been changed in ways that would have been difficult to return back from.
Take me through some of your self-talk there. I know this may be difficult, but I think it's important to get a sense of where you were. How difficult was that decision?
In the end, it wasn't difficult at all. So we learned of Sheila's cancer in June of 2003, and we knew that the election might be called soon, so we spoke to the doctors about how serious it was, and with a view to, if this is really serious, then I shouldn't be asking for people's support if I'm not going to be able to give it my full attention. The doctors and Sheila said, don't worry, this normally isn't the type of cancer that sort of would take somebody's life or to create a serious compromise in their health. Unfortunately, it just didn't turn out to be like that. And so we went through the election in 2003 without telling anyone that she was sick. And then she received treatments through the fall. But it was when the treatments weren't working. And with the type of cancer that she had, thyroid cancer, either the treatment works or nothing works, kind of thing. And we realized quite quickly that we were into a place where we were going to have to make some very dramatic shifts to try to get some experimental treatment and see if she was going to be able to do better. And that was in the late fall of 2003. And it was a total no-brainer that I was going to have to step down as leader and we'd figure out our next steps. So we spent much of the next, you know, few years trying to see what we could do to make her better.
And you had children, obviously, through that time, and yeah. raising your children. What was the most challenging part of that?
I don't generally think of it as a challenge. It was just life. It was just the way that life showed up for us. And obviously, as Sheila became sicker, that became more challenging to explain to the boys. We had three boys who were just, you know, under their teens and just in their early teens. And yeah, the conversations with them then, and, you know, after she passed away, the conversations afterward were really challenging as well. But she was just a rock. You know, she didn't want them to sort of have to experience the sadness of this for any longer than necessary. So they weren't fully in the loop at that time.
Was there ever a time that you thought you might get back into the political world?
No. I still see the importance of that work. And I cheer on people who go into public life regardless. I have been lucky enough to sort of give people advice from all three major political parties who are people who want to go into politics. Just sit down and have a conversation about what's it like. I don't sugarcoat that. But
I just want to interrupt you here because I'd be interested in hearing some of the advice that you do give to people when they choose to do that.
It's not always the advice that they're expecting, because the most common questions that people would come to me with is, what's it like? How do I win? Those kinds of conversations. But for reasons that, you know, I was sharing with you earlier, in order for somebody to be well suited to doing work that is that tumultuous, they need to have a really strong core. They need to have a clear sense of why they're going in, and that regardless of all the noise around them, the boosterism, the pretending that everything we say is right and everything they say is wrong kind of nonsense that goes with this, the only way you're going to be able to survive and succeed as a person is if you at your deepest core have a clear sense of who you are and why you're doing this work, such that when the seas get high, you don't get blown around by those seas. You stay true to who you are. So that's the essence of what I tell them is essentially not political. And that's perhaps for them the surprising part. It's more personal. Mm-hmm. And of course, we eventually get to what's it like. And the things that I generally caution them about are things related to partisanship a bit, and also, you know, the importance of remaining curious and looking at the bigger picture. One of the biggest challenges, especially in that culture where everyone's in a frenetic reactive mode, the biggest challenge that we have in this regard, I think, is the is the depth of the understanding of the issues and the leverage points that are really going to bring about long-term change. The 2003 election that I led our party in had as one of the most important ballot questions the question of what the price of automobile insurance was for Nova Scotians. And I don't for a moment want to pretend that that wasn't an important issue, particularly for people in rural environments who needed a car to get around. But there is nothing about that particular issue that was going to define the future of Nova Scotia. And we passed on so many opportunities to sort of really think at a more fundamental level about what it is that, you know, we want to do as a people. You know, what are we about here in this part of the world? And how can we take advantage of opportunities that I think are around us in this great province? But that requires political leaders and others to dig, to be curious and to dig deep into what the real challenges are.
Well, that's what Engage Nova Scotia presumably is trying to accomplish now, is to figure out what the issues are that are going to define us and figure out how to get people involved in that decision-making process. Is that correct?
It's close.
It's close?
Okay. Yeah, very much. And it's hard to get close to all that work or what it's about in that sense, in fairness, because it's about not us figuring it out, but inviting Nova Scotians for themselves to better understand our challenges, our opportunities, and the hurdles in front of us. So that's one component of it, and it is about inviting more people to step up to improve our economy and our quality of life.
Interestingly, in the job that I have with CFIB, yeah, we spend a lot of time out talking to small business owners, surveying them on a wide array of issues. And some of the things that we find out is that issues that we think are particularly important aren't really on the radar because business owners very often have a lot of other things on their mind other than, you know, public policy decisions or demographic profiles or some of the other, I guess, more arcane bits and pieces here. So I guess my question is, how do we get to a point where people do actually understand what those significant challenges are? Because I'll put forward, I think we're in the beginning of a demographic crisis, and I don't use that word lightly. When we look at what our tax burden is going to be like in the future, when we look at the number of people that we're going to be having to actually carry that weight, when we look at the aging population, healthcare costs, we're moving into a very, very difficult or challenging time economically for this province, perhaps more so than one we've seen for a very, very long time.
So a lot of different pieces to what you're saying. Maybe I'll just approach them from the beginning,
sure,
if you don't mind, Jordy. So it's a mistake to think that there is a tablet that we would all agree on about what the big problems are. We've got a lot of thoughtful people who have genuine disagreements about what's the most important thing to be done. The balance that I'm most interested in is a balance between the important short-term things and the important long-term things. So 2 weeks ago, I was lucky enough to be facilitating a two-day conversation in Port Hawkesbury amongst the five municipal leaders at Leadership Council and so on, and the five Mi'kmaq communities there. And we spent a lot of time sort of narrowing down to what are the most important issues that you think are facing the island. And something quite unexpected from my perspective came up as their number one short-term issue, and they said it was internet and cell service. It is the ability to get on the highway and to have an equal opportunity to compete and have the quality of life through internet that others would have. It just, you know, I know it's a significant issue, but I hadn't realized that it would rise to number one as their issue. And at the same time, they said the long-term issue is that we aren't unified as a people on the island to be more effective in trying to address our challenges. So they were able to go to the short-term, able to go to the long-term over time. The issue of demographics has been around since we were writing reports about Nova Scotia. And back in the 1930s and for almost every decade since, we have written reports like the Ivany Report that sort of described this this cliff that we've been heading toward. And we haven't been able to address it as dramatically, for example, as the Ivany Commission and the 1NS coalition that I was on would have wanted us to do. There are signs that we're taking, I think, the issue more seriously than we did before, and there are signs of progress. All parties need to sort of work together to sort of address their piece of it. At Engage, the things that we have focused on are Share Thanksgiving, for example, where we have set a standard nationally for inviting Nova Scotians to open their door at Thanksgiving time to welcome international students and newcomers to their homes to sort of create relationships. We do that. We don't expect that that's going to suddenly solve all of everybody's problems, but we only have 25% as many newcomers in Nova Scotia as the rest of the country does on average. And the biggest challenge we have is that when people come here, they too often, not in as great as numbers as some say, but too many of them are going to Toronto or Vancouver or Montreal mm-hmm. or Calgary. So we need to find practical ways to create relationships for the people who come here so that they stick and come to appreciate that this is a province that will that is worth them staying, working, and raising families in. And the other tool that we're working on right now is a quality of life index. So this is an index that we think is something that it will potentially become a differentiator for Nova Scotia. Too often we are looking over the fence at Wall Street and Bay Street and thinking that that's the only definition of a good life, without appreciating that there may be some things about the Nova Scotia lifestyle that not everybody enjoys, but many people do enjoy, that become a foreign direct investment differentiator for us. So I think that there are lots of different tools that we can be using that sort of highlight why it's worth staying and committing oneself to Nova Scotia. It's an incredible place to live in. We just need more people to enjoy the benefits of it.
Do you think that the Atlantic provinces cooperate effectively, or could they be cooperating far more effectively to create, to perhaps reduce some of the cost of governance? We have four provincial governments of varying sizes governing a population the size of Vancouver. Yeah. And there are a great number of differences between the way those provinces are governed.
Yeah.
But most, from an aspirational point of view, most Atlantic Canadians are in the same boat, looking towards the same direction. And wondering if there's any discussion that you think that's useful that's going on that's moving us toward that direction as well.
I think there are useful discussions, and there this is an age-old problem.
Yes, it is. I know this goes back to Sir Charles Tupper.
And so the short answer to your question is that we're moving nearly as ambitiously enough, and we haven't been moving ambitiously enough for decades. Full stop. There are so many areas where we could, I think, be doing more, but you can't snap a finger through any single government to sort of make things happen. There's clearly progress. The Atlantic Growth Strategy is intended to sort of bring aspects of that together and get the region thinking more collectively than it has in the past. And at the same time, I think that you can move only at the speed of trust with these issues. And the citizens in each of these, the three maritime provinces, for example, which is the area where this is discussed the most, are more committed to their province politically than they are to the region as a whole. So we need to respect that at the same time. So it's a matter of what leadership brings us to the new opportunity that they see and will buy into. And I think that there are many that we're not getting to in that regard.
Moving at the speed of trust, that looks like a quotable quote. Was that yours, or did that come from somewhere else?
I've been using it so long, I'm not sure whether I originated. So let's just say it was somebody else's.
If it is, then I think we should make sure we attribute it. It's an extraordinary challenge that we're facing here in the region. I think that these are interesting reforms that you're talking about, but we're asking people to come to the table and people to step up. And at the same time, I think our political leadership has a responsibility to look at that cooperation in a really meaningful way by setting aside perhaps some of the retail politics and some of their own specific goals and look at it at the region as a whole. And I'm not sure that that happens very often outside of maybe academic circles or, you know, in conversations like you have.
Perhaps. Yeah, I think there are many people who have been picking at this for a period of time. Mm-hmm. You know, you hear Frank McKenna talking about the importance of this issue, Donald Savoy. I don't know when that sort of the ice is going to finally break and people will go fully in on this.
There's a great quote in Donald Savoy's latest book. He says the biggest, Dr. Savage said, that the greatest impediment to economic development in Nova Scotia is Frank McKenna. And that's...
I didn't hear that.
And that basically sums it up because, you know, as long as we're not, we're working at cross purposes, then, you know, we can use all the cliches of, you know, tide should raise all boats and all that kind of stuff. But I hope that our political leadership will look at that a little more closely. So you mentioned this earlier, but it is the question that I do have to ask. What do you think has been your most instructive failure or a setback that you've had that set you up for future success?
I think it was not making that hockey team when I was, frankly, 19 years old, 18 years old, whatever it was, 19, because I realized that it was extremely painful, but a whole new world opened up for me as a result of that loss. And then not being afraid to fail has become really an important piece for me in that regard. If I were to sort of make it potentially more relevant for your listeners, I despite all the altruism that I've expressed about why I got into politics and what my trajectory was, none of us who go through this are unscathed or are in any way saintly in the work that we did. And I can remember once I was sitting around the caucus table for my caucus, and the heat was rising because I was talking about things like citizen-centered democracy and not about paving roads when I first became leader of the party. And people were asking why I was doing this, and I eventually caught myself in a moment where I heard myself say, "We'll worry about whether this is in the best interests of Nova Scotians down the road. All I want are the four issues that are going to ensure that we form government in the next election and we make a difference." And when I heard myself say that, I realized, oh man, in this short a period of time, despite all that altruism, you uttered those words. And it forsaked a lot of what I valued the most. And I kind of caught myself and heard myself in that regard. And that story has sort of helped me adjust my perspective and helped me realize that the people who are serving in public life are serving in a context that is far too toxic, no matter how altruistic you are. And that story comes on the heels of me having once gone to, John Hamm was going to announce the appointment of two new members to his cabinet who were from Dartmouth and from Industrial Cape Breton. And my caucus sort of loaded me for bear and said, you know, this time, would you go over there and would just be critical for a change or something like that? And I went over there and I listened to what he explained at the microphone. I thought Dartmouth and Industrial Cape Breton should have somebody around the cabinet table, full stop. They said that I should be saying that it was about saving their seats and that sort of thing. And so I, you know, was mostly complimentary about the decision. I went back and our caucus, there you go again. And they forgave me. The party that didn't get it was the media. And so a meeting was arranged between me and a member of the press gallery where I was going to be told the facts of life in a breakfast meeting. And that, and I was told at that meeting that it had already been discussed amongst the media that if I wasn't going to be more critical, then they were going to stop reporting on me. So when I describe to you that it's not, this cocktail of politics and distrust and all the rest is one that goes in many different directions, written and unwritten, about the way that people all conduct themselves in this work. And I share this story, I've never shared any of the, and I wouldn't, the names of people associated with that, but it was the kind of eye-opener that sort of made me really take stock of how we need to foster a new dialogue around our how we have public discourse and carve a new way that goes deeper and longer than what we've got right now.
How do we do that in an environment where, the Federal Party ran on a platform that included, as a very predominant part of it, that there was going to be electoral reform. Mm. And they put together a committee, and the committee came up with nothing, and it just seems to have gone. And it's not, I'm sure, because there weren't people who were committed to actually making that happen. I don't know. Are there suggestions that you have around what could have been done more effectively to perhaps at least get an outcome?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to be unfair by picking out that very obvious break in the promise that the current federal government made. It's, for many people, the most egregious example of where a promise was made and then it has not been acted upon.
Yeah, I don't want to frame this as a criticism of the government, but more so
of what the context is.
What the context is and how you can actually achieve some of those things, because the status quo is an awfully difficult object to climb over.
Yeah. So I think that there are a lot of seemingly little things that others might not get that I think that we need to understand and have a conversation about the role of the media with a more grown-up look at what the objectives that drive their work is and the degree to which it has been forced into these short, pithy, conflict-driven kind of sound bites. And that's part of the public appetite, so it all traces back. Mm-hmm. I think that there is I'd love to see a code of civility that had teeth amongst political leaders, where we called each other when there was total BS that was being expressed and that there was some kind of an independent party that could see this. I'd like to see opportunities for greater collaboration. I'd be interested in seeing whether if you simply dispersed the members in legislatures and parliament so that they're sitting beside people from other parties, the degree to which it might foster relationships and sort of change things. I'd love to see an orientation camp before people take office, to sit them down in an off-site location for a couple of days to spend time getting to know each other as real people across parties, and for that to continue over time so that you can still talk about your differences, your different ideas, but you don't reach that sort of really harsh, crisp level of stuff. We live in a time where as a result of this is bear with me for this one observation. I think that perhaps the most concerning trend globally and locally relates to the decline of trust. And there's a barometer called the Edelman Barometer that describes globally the decline in trust in government, in media, in business, and even not-for-profits. And this has created an environment in all countries, Canada's not immune to this, where people think that the system's not working and it's out to screw them. And so we start to go it alone. And our ability to come together around the most important shared collective issues that we have is substantially diminished. You know, we introduced the Canada Health Act back in the 1960s, where people actually trusted government quite substantially. While we point our finger at our colleagues south of the border who haven't been able to get a robust public health care system in place, I think we need to ask ourselves, even as Canadians, although we have a far better system for the collective, would we have been able to sort of get something like that through, like the Canada Health Act, if we were to start it now? So The big issue is trust, and it goes in many directions, not just amongst politicians.
Is there a book that you would give to every graduating student, either coming out of high school or coming out of university?
I think I'd probably, I could think of two books, if you don't mind. One would be, I think it's a little late to give the first book to somebody before they graduate from high school, because a lot of the values are set in at a much earlier time. And I'd give this to parents as well. There's a book called You Are Special that is a children's book that is about, fundamentally, it's just, you know, a very simple children's book that I used to read to my kids quite regularly at home. And it's about accepting each other and not trying to pretend that we're better or worse than we are as people, but just figuring out how to accept each other. And the other one that comes to mind, which is obviously a much more developed read, is one that I think would be appropriate around that time that you described, you know, early adulthood, and it's called The Gift of Imperfection by Brené Brown. And our young people are given these notions that they've got to be all that in a bag of chips. And so they try to climb this ladder to somewhere that they can't quite see without really understanding that the mistakes that they make in their lives are and the wrong turns, the sadness that sometimes comes, the fact that you don't have it all together may be the most important thing for you to pay attention to in the here and now, instead of getting caught up in trying to be somebody else, somebody that somebody else is or society is inviting you to be.
Brené Brown.
B-R-E-N-E.
Yes.
Brown.
Brown, and the Gift of Imperfection.
Yeah.
Okay. So do you have a specific credo, or is there a quote that you've kind of held close to your heart that's guided your life?
Yeah, well, the one, if I were to ask my children what I've repeated most often, I think they'd come up with four words, and that is that everyone has a story. And I learned that from the gifts that have come to me as a result of having my son Patrick, who has Down syndrome, and he's on the autistic spectrum, and he's been my greatest teacher. And from my time as a defense lawyer, frankly, when I started to tell courts the story of somebody whose life was a lot more disadvantaged than mine was when I got in. So the credo that I invite my boys to think about before they say something, just think about what their story is. And a related one is that those least like us may have the most to teach us. And so that has been sort of in my adult life, sort of an abiding sort of interest, and it's not an easy one when you get cranky and you see people really messing up badly or messing up other people's lives, or you know that, but those are the two that sort of stand out for me.
Danny, it's been a real pleasure. I had many other things that I wanted to talk to you about. We could probably do another one of these someday. I don't know. Maybe we can do a round two someday, but thank you so much for taking some time to talk to me.
My pleasure.
I hope you've enjoyed today's edition of Fall Back Up. The intent of this podcast is to provide you with engaging and thoughtful insights into Atlantic Canada through conversations with business leaders, innovators, and high performers. The greatest resource of our region is its people. And I dig down to try to understand what drives the people who are making a difference in our regional community. If you know of someone you'd like to hear interviewed, please let me know. Feel free to leave a comment on my site. The radio program and podcast are made possible in part by the Canadian Federation of Independent Business. CFIB is Canada's largest business association, representing the interests of 109,000 small and medium-sized businesses across the country, with 11,000 of those entrepreneurs right here in Atlantic Canada. For more on what CFIB can do for your business, visit www.cfib.ca. CFIB, in business for your business. Fall Back Up is also heard on community radio throughout the Maritimes, and it originates from CIOE 97.5 in Lower Sackville, Nova Scotia. I'm Jordy Morgan. Thanks for listening.